The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Well, welcome back. Wednesday, December 7th, 2022. I am Seth Leibson. The phone number is 602-508-0960, 602-5080-960. Anything on your mind? Want to welcome back Jeremy and David, who are doing production for us today. Bill is out. He'll be back tomorrow. David, of course, is our new associate producer. Yesterday's election in Georgia reveals something I cannot completely wrap my head around. On November 8th, Herschel Walker received 1.9 million votes. Yesterday, he received 1.7 million votes. Herschel Walker received about 200,000 fewer votes yesterday than a month ago. Raphael Warnock received about 100,000 less than a month ago. Herschel Walker lost the election yesterday by a total of about 95,000 votes. What the actual heck were voters doing and thinking? Within the period of a month, some 200,000 Walker voters didn't vote. Have that number, and he'd be the senator-elect today. Is enthusiasm a problem for us? No doubt it is, and it's a damn shame because now we all have to listen to Raphael Warnock for the next 6 years, and don't think he won't be considered a vice presidential candidate if Joe Biden opts not to run in 2 years. That would mean Kamala Harris not being Joe Biden's running mate, because, of course, Raphael Warnock will be on anyone's shortlist for vice president if Joe Biden decides not to. I was listening to Charlie Kirk this morning talking about those who put the damper on Republican voting and voting enthusiasm. He, like me, has absolutely no patience for this. These preemptive political surrenders, we might call them. They are surrenders not just of conservatism in the Republican Party. They are surrenders of our country. Preemptive surrenders of America from a party and within a party that used to pretty much control the own the franchise on patriotism and didn't define patriotism, by the way, through enthusiasm and compliance for wearing medical masks and broadcasting public fear and illness. There are fewer than 170,000 World War II veterans alive today. My dad was one of them until he passed about 7 years ago. I remark on the World War II point, given today being December 7th, famously a day that was supposed to live in infamy, because, as on September 11th, 2001, evil and good were amazingly, starkly, in sharp relief, clearly revealed in 2001. And now we have self-doubt about such judgments regarding good and evil. In a better, different, stronger America in the 1940s, we had no such confusion. It wasn't sewed into the fabric of our culture by the pseudo-sophisticates. The revelation 20 years ago, 21 years ago, lasted about a month. The revelation 81 years ago lasted a great deal longer. 81 years ago, plus one day, a Democratic president could stand before a joint session of Congress and say, quote, "The American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory. I believe that I interpret the will of the Congress and of the people when I assert that we will not only defend ourselves to the uttermost, but will make it very certain that this form of treachery shall never again endanger us." Close quote. Note the use of the word righteous. That was not a strange or unique word describing how we thought about ourselves 80 or so years ago. Today, I can't imagine a Democratic Party leader speaking of America as righteous. How could one? We are systematically racist. We are filled with deplorables. We are arrogant. Democratic presidents today now go around the world apologizing for America, not speaking to other nations or ourselves about our decency, much less our righteousness or greatness. Exceptionalism is another word you don't hear in the Democratic Party. Did we have a race problem back then when Democrats were comfortable talking about American exceptionalism? We knew we were the greatest country ever then. We all did. Were we not as racist? You bet we were racist back then. We had big race problems, bigger than we have now, obviously. This was all before the Civil Rights Acts, by a little more than two decades. When the boxer Joe Louis enlisted to fight in World War II, a friend said, quote, "It's a white man's army, Joe. It ain't a black man's army," close quote. Joe Louis looked at him, didn't blink an eye, and explained his decision, quote, "Lots of things wrong with America, but Hitler ain't going to fix any of them," close quote. He understood how to make judgments back then in a less equal and even, sadly, more racist America. Winston Churchill, too, understood us really well back then. In his memoirs of World War II, this is how he wrote of his thoughts on the night of December 7th, 1941, upon learning of the attack on Pearl Harbor. Churchill wrote this, quote, "At this very moment, I knew the United States was in the war, up to the neck and into the death. So we had won after all. Yes, after Dunkirk, after the fall of France, after the horrible episode of Oran, after the threat of invasion, we had won the war. England would live. Britain would live. The Commonwealth of Nations and the Empire would live. How long the war would last or in what fashion it would end, no man could tell, nor did I at this moment care. We would not be wiped out. Our history would not come to an end. We might not even have to die as individuals. Hitler's fate was sealed. Mussolini's fate was sealed. As for the Japanese, they would be ground to powder. Many disasters, immeasurable cost and tribulation would lay ahead, but there was no more doubt about the result, about the end." Close quote. He knew once America was attacked, the war was over or would be over. He continued in his memoirs this way, quote, "Silly people, and there were many, not only in enemy countries, they might discount the force of the United States. Some said they were soft, others that they would never be united. They would fool around at a distance. They would never come to grips. They would never stand bloodletting. Their democracy and system of recurrent elections would paralyze their war efforts. They would be just a vague blur on the horizon to friend or foe. Now, we should see the weakness of this numerous but remote, wealthy, and talkative people. But I had studied the American Civil War, fought out to the last desperate inch. American blood flowed in my veins. And I thought of a remark which Edward Grey, a former British Secretary of State, had made to me more than 30 years earlier, that the United States is like a gigantic boiler. Once the fire is lighted under it, there is no limit to the power it can generate. Being saturated and satiated with emotion and sensation, I went to bed and slept the sleep of the saved and thankful," close quote. That was Churchill. You feel like we're still that gigantic boiler these days? You think we are a culture that believes there is no limit to the power we can generate? Or do you think rather we are so filled and consumed with self-doubt and moral relativism and misplaced and misdirected self-critique and criticism that we don't even think we have a right to speak of, much less exercise our power or our strengths? Professor Charles Kessler, who will be with us tomorrow, wrote something a couple of years ago very much worth recalling today. He reminded that in Ronald Reagan's farewell address to the nation in 1989, Reagan said, quote, "Those of us who are over 35 or so years of age, i.e. born before 1954, we grew up in a different America. We were taught very directly what it meant to be an American, and we absorbed, almost in the air, a love of country and an appreciation of its institutions. If you didn't get a sense of patriotism from your family and neighborhood, you got it from your school and the popular culture," Reagan said. Close quote. As Kessler points out, by the cusp of the 1990s, however, something had changed for the worse. Reagan captured it in a single understated sentence when he said, quote, "Younger parents aren't sure that an unambivalent appreciation of America is the right thing to teach modern children," close quote. The children of those ambivalent parents have grown up and begun to have families of their own, usually with fewer children. The growing uncertainty about the country now extends in many cases to the second and third generation of her puzzled citizens. Is it any wonder that a nation torn between loathing and loving itself seems sometimes to be on the verge of a nervous breakdown? The American people hardly know what to think about America anymore. Less than 3 years ago, the New York Times announced its 1619 project that American slavery was more fundamental than American freedom. Anti-black racism is in America's DNA, explained the project's organizer, Nicole Hannah-Jones, who is black. Now, here's what gets me. Nicole Hannah-Jones's father and grandfather were Army veterans. Nicole Hannah-Jones's dad had flown the American flag in his modest front yard every day of his life. Quote, I had been taught in school through cultural osmosis, Hannah-Jones writes, that the flag wasn't really ours, that our history as a people began with enslavement and that we had contributed little to this great nation. As a young woman, she felt ashamed that, quote, my dad felt so much honor in being an American, dismissing his patriotism as a, quote, marker of his degradation. And she then convinced her dad to take that flag down. You see what happened and is happening here. Nicole Hannah-Jones, age 46 today, learned in school that her dad, who served in the U.S. Army, was wrong to take and have pride in this country and fly its flag. And she took those lessons home from school to convince her dad to stop flying that flag. Good thing Joe Lewis didn't have a daughter in postmodern American schools. Good thing Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill weren't educated in the postmodern schools of America. Good thing most Americans weren't. So today, as Sir Thomas More says in A Man for All Seasons, I show you the times. The times of an education system that knows or claims to know more about this country than people who actually grew up and suffered for it and didn't have to study history from pseudo-sophisticated intellectuals because they didn't study history, they made history. I mentioned Nicole Hannah-Jones yesterday. She's threatening to strike with her fellow employees at the New York Times, which employs her and sponsors the 1619 Project. She hasn't written anything for the Times in a few years. I don't know why they still employ her, or maybe I do. It's good to have someone on staff that runs an education curriculum that runs America down and teaches that freedom and equality are not our founding ethos, but that slavery and racism are. A curriculum that teaches Churchill and Roosevelt were wrong. When Winston Churchill did die in 1965, Professor Leo Strauss, my teacher, Harry Jaffa's teacher, Leo Strauss was told as he was about to deliver a lecture to his students at the University of Chicago. Without notes, without thinking about it extemporaneously, this is what Leo Strauss said. Quote, the death of Churchill is a healthy reminder to academic students of political science of their limitations, the limitations of their craft. The tyrant stood at the pinnacle of his power. The contrast between the indomitable and magnanimous statesman and the insane tyrant. This spectacle in its clear simplicity was one of the greatest lessons which men can learn at any time. He went on to say, quote, the death of Churchill reminds us of the limitations of our craft and therefore our duty. We have no higher duty and no more pressing duty than to remind ourselves and our students of political greatness, human greatness, of the peaks of human excellence. For we are supposed to train ourselves and others in seeing things as they are. And this means, above all, in seeing their greatness and their misery, their excellence and their vileness, their nobility and their triumphs, and therefore never to mistake mediocrity, however brilliant, for true greatness. In our age, this duty demands of us, in the first place, that we liberate ourselves from the supposition that value statements cannot be factual statements, close quote. We don't have teaching like that anymore because we don't have teachers like that anymore. And thus we no longer are able to distinguish tyranny and freedom, good and evil, greatness and misery. And yeah, all we do now is run down the values and aspirations to those values that made us so great and made us and others think of us as so great not so long ago. We are in great need just now, as the novelist Tom Wolfe once put it, of a great relearning? Do we have the capacity to grasp it? Do we have the capacity to teach it? I'm Seth Leibson, 602-508-0960. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Gold has been used as money for nearly 3,000 years, and today, gold remains a common-sense investment that's simple and straightforward. You don't need a pushy commission salesperson to tell you why you should buy gold. You probably already want it. What you need is a reputable dealer with advice based on experience and a complete range of coins and bullion so you get what you want at the best value. That's the Midas Gold Group. They're veteran-owned. They're proud supporters of this show, this station right here on 960 AM. They're fighting for your right to the financial privacy and stability and security that gold offers. Trust the dealer that I and Sebastian Gorka and thousands of you already know and trust, Midas Gold Group. You can visit them in person at 625 West Deer Valley Road in Phoenix or give them a call at 480-360-3000. That's 480-360-3000 or online at MidasGoldGroup.com. This will be interesting to follow. We don't have a lot of news on this. It'll be interesting to see actually if it makes a lot of news anywhere. FoxNews.com headline, New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is under investigation by the House Ethics Committee. The story is under a House Ethics investigation, according to a statement issued by the House Committee on Ethics on Wednesday. The panel will announce its course of action after its organizational meeting in the next Congress sometime in 2023. The statement said details about what the investigation is looking into haven't been released. The Office of Congressional Ethics, a nonpartisan group, forwarded its inquiry into Ocasio-Cortez to the House Ethics Panel. Committee Acting Chair Susan Wild, D of Penn, and Ranking Member Michael Guest, R of Mississippi, said the disclosure of the investigation does not itself indicate that any violation has occurred or reflect any judgment on behalf of the committee. Interesting. If this were a Republican, it would already be leaked as to what this is about. And not only would it be leaked as to what this is about, it would be hysterical. It would just short of hysterical. You know, there was not a single investigation into any Republican that maintained the courtesy of confidentiality ever. And you certainly saw that with Donald Trump. And by the way, might I ask, did we ever find out and solve who leaked the Dobbs decision from the United States Supreme Court in an unprecedented move that had never happened with the Supreme Court, released it to the public, released it to the press? Who released it to the public? Long before the summer announcement of the Dobbs decision, the Supreme Court staff is not that large. It really isn't. You think people in charge don't know? You think the investigators don't know who leaked that to the papers? Will we ever know? Will we ever find out? Or do the norms only matter for one team in Washington? Seems like that is the rule right now. The norms only matter for one team in Washington. If you're a Republican, you're going to always be the away team with the referees. That's going to change a little bit. Hopefully a lot more than a little, but certainly a little bit with the House now under Republican control. So sad that we won't have the Senate at a 50-50 tie. You know what that means, though? Perhaps it means a little less Kamala Harris. They won't need to bring her in to break those tie votes and give the Democrats their majority. Every silver lining, though, has a gray one as well. We're going to have to listen to more of Raphael Warnock. And that's going to be all to our detriment. What the heck happened to those 200,000 voters that voted for Herschel Walker a month ago that were not to be found yesterday? 602-508-0960. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Liebson Show. That's a great song to come in with. Eastbound and Down from Smokey and the Bandit. From thereabouts in Atlanta, Georgia, is our loyal listener, Keith. Hi, Keith. How are you?
I'm doing okay, Seth. How are you?
I'm fine. Tell me what happened, baby.
I don't know what happened. They say, they speculate it was the weather or whatever. And that's really a shame that if you couldn't bear the weather. I went out and voted early anyways. But if you couldn't stand in for a couple of hours and just handle it, the state really needed that vote. I mean, Herschel Walker really needed it. But, you know, you say we got to listen to Raphael Warnock for the next few years. I'm the one who's got to listen to that guy.
Believe me, he's going to get national attention, Keith. It won't just be you. We have to pay for your sins. I'm sorry to tell you that.
And, you know, he has no fear now because he got reelected.
Yep.
He's like Mark Kelly to you. For 2 years, he just had to behave himself. Now he got reelected. And how Mark Kelly said the border was his priority? No, it's not his priority anymore.
It's a good analysis, but I'll take Mark Kelly over Raphael any day for only one reason. Mark Kelly really doesn't talk. He doesn't.
Yeah.
He doesn't seek the Klieg lights. Raphael Warnock does. This is a preacher, man. He is going to be out there, baby.
Yeah, and he preaches a lot of stirring up the hate and all that other stuff.
Oh, yeah.
There's sermons he had, and Herschel Walker never pulled him up with him really throwing the rhetoric around.
Yeah.
And it's really sad because I saw the ads. They just bombed Herschel Walker and made him out. They made Herschel Walker to be out to be Raphael Warnock.
Yeah.
And Raphael Warnock is the unaccomplished scumbag and stuff like that. But here's my question for you. Do you believe that we're going to be better off in a few years? Here's my take, real quick. I think that we're in the whole nation is becoming Chicago and California. It's never going to vote. It's never going to say we've had enough of this.
That's a great question because I had a strong discussion with a dear friend this morning about that, and we're kind of on different sides of it. I mean, we're both conservative Republicans, but we both came out differently on this. I don't know, Keith. I don't know what my thinking is. Is that we need to, you know, we need to do a lot better, not just in our candidates. We do need to do better in our candidates and in our candidate recruitment, but we need to do better in our campaigning too. You know, we had some problems here in Arizona. I think a lot of them were avoidable if we were a little bit more alert, if we were listening to perhaps more right voices than wrong voices. But, you know, it's going to take some maturity. It's a bigger conversation than I have in this segment, but I sure hope so, because as Ronald Reagan said about his friend who migrated here from Cuba in 1964, you know, at least I had somewhere to go to. Where else are we going to go if we don't save this thing, if we don't grow up and get our act together? Where else are we going to go?
Right.
There's nowhere else to go. This is it. This is the last stand on earth is how Ronald Reagan finished that story.
And I work with a guy who came from Venezuela. And he said,
you get it.
And he said, we better fight for this country because this is the Alamo. That's what his quote was. This is the Alamo.
Wow.
After this, there is nothing left. He said, you better fight for it because you don't know what is going to happen when this place becomes Venezuela.
Well,
what I'm getting at is this, Seth. How bad does it have to get for a Democrat voter to say, I'm not voting for them?
This is the eternal question I can't understand. I mean, I looked at that recall race in California between Gavin Newsom and Larry Elder. I mean, California, aside from its God-given beauty, is a basket case at every level and at every index. And, you know, you had a chance to put in a smart, articulate man, Republican, Larry Elder, who, you know, wears loosely, you know, is not a fire and brimstone guy, who is an energetic intellectual. And, you know, California just said no in a big way. There's an old French phrase. Do you speak French, David? Nostalgia de la buie. There is this nostalgia, this desire to live in muck, mud, misery, that is imbued, I think, too much of the voting population, too much of the population, Keith. And, you know, maybe it's about candidate recruitment. Maybe it's about good and bad advice during elections. But we better grow up and smarten up. You bet we better. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Since it's Wednesday, we have the privilege of being joined by Brett Johnson. He is our constitutional and elections attorney. He is a partner with the law firm of Snell and Wilmer, swlaw.com, based here in Phoenix, but offices around the country. Brett, how are you, sir?
Good, good. Thanks for having me.
You betcha. You know, there's a couple cases this week in front of the Supreme Court. But two in particular that kind of struck me as interesting. ACLU has a press release out on a case. I think it's being argued today, Moore versus Harper, and their press release says this is the Supreme Court case that could upend democracy. Sounds to me like sounds to me a little strong, but should we be worried?
Sounds like a good fundraising press release. Okay. So, I don't think that anybody should be worried by any means. I mean, we've actually talked about this case before, yeah. Because Moore versus Harper deals with North Carolina and how North Carolina state law handles their redistricting system. And obviously, what we've talked about before, redistricting is of the political lines. It happens every 10 years after the census. The redistricting process is by its very nature political, and it's also tied to elections. Like how are we going about to hold our elections? And therefore, a lot of our laws that we've been talking about for the last few weeks dealing with election law also deal with redistricting law. So I think what the ACLU is trying to say is that if the Moore case goes south from their perspective, then it's going to have a ramification against all election laws, and we might as well just get rid of the Constitution. I think that they're being a little bit hyperbole there, and also they might not have actually listened to the argument yesterday.
Is it interesting to you, or should it be interesting to us, maybe, in the audience, the role judges have in these redistricting issues?
It is. You know, I mean, obviously, there's a third branch of government. They're all equal for a reason. But it's really comes down to, and by the way, there's a lot of judges on the right side who believe this, too, about judicial activism,
yeah,
as to whether or not they should be engaged in creating policy or just calling balls and strikes based off of the words of a statute. And that is kind of like the balance back and forth. In the North Carolina case, the Constitution, the North Carolina Constitution, which was basically amended to allow this, said that if the legislature was not able to do the political lines, as has been done for 200 odd years, then the Supreme Court could step in and basically draw lines for the state. And that's what happened. And basically what the North Carolina legislature is saying is that, hey, that actually violates the U.S. Constitution, which clearly makes redistricting a power within the state legislature. And so the argument now goes back and forth as to, well, what does that exactly mean? Is there a federal type mentality, or is there a state rights issue where each state is able to come up with its own framework? Now, it's very interesting, right? Because we have more of a conservative bent that is pushing this, hey, we have to look at the federal constitution, and you should not be looking at how a state crafts that.
Yeah.
Well, on any other issue, it's usually federal government, you stay over in Washington, D.C., and we'll handle this in our own backyard. So it's always interesting. It depends on which issue is being raised as to whether or not you raise federalism or state rights issues or more of a centralist government type perspective.
Some states, and straighten me out, Arizona just got out from one, or maybe I'm wrong about that. Some states are under consent decrees and under continual judicial review for how they handle elections, correct? Or am I misstating it? Or am I dangerous enough to say?
No, no, you're not. Okay. You're not. That's the Shelby County case.
Okay.
And basically, 10 years ago, and it goes all the way back to the Civil Rights Act, in the 60s, is that there was a called Section 5.
Right.
And Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act basically said that for certain states that have a history of discrimination in the electoral process needed to have new election laws approved by the Department of Justice before they went into effect.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Now, what Shelby County basically said is that, hey, that's out past time. There's no more evidence of the ongoing systemic discrimination. And so they removed Section 5, which was always meant to be temporary.
Uh-huh.
So Arizona and the rest of the states were no longer under Section 5. Now, don't get me wrong, based off of a variety of different cases, there's always the movement to try to reinsert a Section 5 type analysis. I'm going to bore you here for be academic under what's called Section 2.
Okay.
So just like everything else, they try to maneuver around a statute to get to their objectives. But right now, we're not under review by the Department of Justice.
Okay. There was another case that is, this is the one that I found even a little bit more sexy, if you will, that was argued, I think, on Monday. And that was, it's called 303 Creative. And it's another religious liberty case, kind of like the Bake Shop case, but a little bit different, right?
It is, and we've actually talked about
yep.
this case before
mm-hmm.
on the program. It's basically a person who's up in Colorado who did not want to message on websites for same-sex marriages.
Mm-hmm. Based on her religious objection. She didn't want to create websites for same-sex weddings or marriages.
Correct. Right? And what Colorado said was that's a violation of our accommodation laws.
Mm-hmm.
And let me make sure everybody understands what accommodation laws are. Accommodation laws are basically you go into a restaurant, it also goes back to the civil rights era. You go into a restaurant and you are excluded from getting service in a public accommodation area,
mm-hmm.
getting like a restaurant, based off of your race or your gender, or in many cases for most states, a sexual orientation,
mm-hmm.
where you cannot reject somebody. I see that you're in a same-sex relationship. I am not going to serve you food,
right?
That's a public accommodation. Well, what the court has said in this case and the case that you mentioned, as well as in Arizona, the Nib and Brush case, is that when you're actually talking about messaging, when you're now you're violating my First Amendment rights because I do not want to carry your message. If you want to come in and order cupcakes or something that does not have a message on it, that is every right under the public accommodation. But the moment you tell me I want you to put this message on that cake or this message on that wedding invitation, now you're infringing on my rights because I don't want to say that.
You are compelling someone to speak something they don't agree with or believe
exactly.
in.
Exactly.
Okay.
That's right. So it's a little bit different than but it's the intertwining of the First Amendment between the freedom of religion and also obviously free speech to not be forced to speak. So it's a lot of First Amendment. Ironically, it's also incidental. So if there's a law in place that's incidental and just kind of maybe implicating your free speech, the court is willing to say, hey, it's incidental, it's so minor, the First Amendment is going to fold for that incidental. And one of those cases, ironically, was one of my last cases in the military, Rumsfeld versus the Forum, what we call FAIR, which basically banned what Yale and Harvard wanted to ban military recruiters, and they said it was our First Amendment right to exclude them on.
Yeah.
And what the courts came back and said, well, that's really an incidental.
Yeah.
You're taking the military's money. You need to let the recruiters on campus. So it all comes full circle back, and it just shows on that one, the conservative wing of the Supreme Court, based off of how I'm reading the tea leaves, of course, are most likely going to be ruling in favor of 303.
Yeah, I think it's a 6-3, don't you?
I do.
Yeah.
In the Moore versus Harper, not to go back to the redistricting one, it's a closer one.
Yeah.
If you would have
had
this conversation a month ago, I would have said North Carolina would probably win the legislature based off of Chief Justice Roberts. But based off of the questions that were being asked today, it's a toss-up as to whether or not they're going to say that only the legislature has the powers.
Well done, Brett Johnson. Thank you, sir. Appreciate
no problem.
It. A lot
out
segment.
There.
Brett Johnson is with the Snell and Wilmer Law Firm, SW Law. No loss of principal if time. Your interest is compounded daily. You're paid monthly. There are no fees. As I say, it's a secure and collateralized portfolio that delivers an up to 10.25% rate of return. That's right, up to 10.25%. YRefi is a due diligence approved firm, and you can check them out at investyrefi.com. That's invest, the letter Y, R-E-F-Y.com, or call them at 888-YRefi-34. I was thinking about that conversation with Brett. You know, we've been talking a little bit about Alexis de Tocqueville here. Even in the 1840s, as far back at the 1840s, Tocqueville observed in Democracy in America that there is scarcely a political question in America that will not end up in the courts. If the 6-3 majority we have in the Supreme Court amounts to ultimately anything, I hope it is the reduction of that. Less, or I should say probably fewer, political questions turned into judicial arguments. Maintain your lane. Each department, each area of government, legislative, judicial, executive, maintain your lanes and quit crossing over and quit making every political fight something the ACLU has to mess with. I'm Seth Leibson. We'll be right back. Portions of this show are brought to you by our good friends at YRefi. If you're concerned about stock market volatility, YRefi has an investment for you in a portfolio with a high fixed rate of return not correlated to the stock market. It's a portfolio where you can turn your monthly income on or off, compound it, whatever you choose, and there's no loss of principal if you need your money back at any time. Your interest is compounded daily. You're paid monthly. There are no fees. As I say, it's a secure and collateralized portfolio that delivers an up to 10.25% rate of return. That's right, up to 10.25%. YRefi is a due diligence approved firm, and you can check them out at investyrefi.com. That's invest, the letter Y, R-E-F-Y.com, or call them at 888-YRefi-34. I was thinking about that conversation with Brett. You know, we've been talking a little bit about Alexis de Tocqueville here. Even in the 1840s, as far back at the 1840s, Tocqueville observed in Democracy in America that there is scarcely a political question in America that will not end up in the courts. If the 6-3 majority we have in the Supreme Court amounts to ultimately anything, I hope it is the reduction of that. Less, or I should say probably fewer, political questions turned into judicial arguments. Maintain your lane. Each department, each area of government, legislative, judicial, executive, maintain your lanes and quit crossing over and quit making every political fight something the ACLU has to mess with. I'm Seth Leibson. We'll be right back.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.